This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
Hello and welcome to the summer season of the Philosopher's Zone. I'm Alan Saunders. This week, a chance to revisit Philosophy 101. We've been talking about philosophy at this time for nearly a year now, but what's it all about? Actually, I want to suggest that what it's all about is perhaps the most basic philosophical question, but we'll see what our guests think. Now, I don't know what the collective noun for philosophers is, a confusion of philosophers, perhaps. That's what we've got here. Dr. David Braddon Mitchell, Associate Professor in Philosophy at the University of Sydney, Dr. Caroline West, lecturer in the same department, and Dr. Karen Lai, Senior Lecturer in the School of Philosophy at the University of New South Wales. And as we were walking into the studio, Caroline was saying that this question, what is philosophy, what do you do if you're a philosopher, is the question that all philosophers dread. It comes up at parties or when you're sitting next to somebody in an aeroplane.
That's right, and you're always tempted, well, I'm always tempted to not say that I do philosophy in order to avoid the follow-up question, which is, well, what exactly is it that philosophers do? Because I think that is actually one of the hardest questions in philosophy. And it's a question that a lot of us who teach philosophy face every year or two when we have to try and work out what to say to prospective first-year students about what philosophy is. And most prospective students don't have a clear idea really about what they're getting into if they sign up to do philosophy. And so you're asked to give a pithy 15-minute talk on what philosophy is. And lately I've started trying to explain what philosophy is rather than by offering a list of necessary and sufficient conditions for it. I try and do some. So take a problem of philosophy and show how philosophers have analysed the problem and offered different kinds of answers to it.
Yeah, there are different ways of introducing students to philosophy, aren't there, David? I mean, one of them is to give them a book called, you know, An Introduction to Philosophy, or give them a piece of philosophy, say Descartes' Meditations is a very popular one, or something by Plato, and just plunge them in. What do you prefer?
I'm a plunger. I start by giving a lecture which basically covers three or four big questions in philosophy, and run my own little spiel about what philosophy is, which is philosophy builds a bridge between the kind of picture that natural sciences give us of the way the world is and the common sense picture, which always seems to be very disconnected. And you try and connect those things and get a big picture of how things are. But what I always find is that when you start talking about what philosophy is, people are very confused and they start to ask the very questions that we all hear dread to hear at parties. And those party questions are real questions, actually, because what they show is there's a kind of personality disorder in philosophy. Philosophy does two totally different sorts of things. There's the love of truth and the love of wisdom, and quite possibly the love of truth and the love of wisdom aren't the same thing, and a very different sort of approach is required to pursue the two endeavours.
Well, that's certainly an issue I want to come on to shortly. I have to say, I was once at a party, and I met somebody, and he said, what do you do? And I said, I'm a graduate student in logic and scientific method, which is essentially philosophy. And I said, what do you do? And he said, I'm a forklift truck driver. So we talked about forklift truck driving quite a lot. Karen, are you a plunger or do you prefer general introductions?
Oh, a plunger. Very, very much believe philosophy is an activity. And I do believe, too, it's an activity for everyone. And certainly this is the view you get in ancient Chinese philosophy, where, you know, you reflect. People reflect on all sorts of things, you know, starting with Confucius, for instance, reflecting on the way of life, saying this is not good enough. So taking a step back, actually, and I think a philosopher is someone who perhaps sits on a perch, as it were, and looks down, and maybe that's why it's sometimes revered, sometimes hated.
Now, I suggested that what's it all about is the basic philosophical question. And I think it's philosophical because it's a question about the whole of experience rather than a bit of it. So it's not like asking what is physics, what is plumbing, what is forklift truck driving. David, do you think I'm onto something there?
I think you're onto something, but I think that something I think that Karen said and I said a moment ago tells you that the what it's all about question is itself a sort of a a schizophrenic question. You might ask it for two different reasons. You might ask it because you think that reflecting on what it's all about will actually help your life and help the life of your community. Or you might ask it because you really want to sort out what it could be all about, if anything. Now, the answer to that second question, pursued as an activity directed towards truth, might produce the unpleasant answer, nothing. But if the first activity is what you want to do, you better not produce that answer. You better do something else. So if philosophy is an activity, it could be an activity with two goals. One could be improvement. The other could be, in some sort of vaguely objective, quasi-scientific sense, truth. And those goals aren't the same goal. So it might be two very different activities, both of which are legitimately called philosophy. Mm. And I actually think sometimes philosophy goes wrong when people confuse those goals. They believe they're the same goal. And so they have constraints on their truth-directed activity by, it better be good for me to discover this truth. And they have constraints on their it being good for them activities, which is they better be constrained by what's objectively true.
Karen, I think of Chinese philosophy as being very concerned, classical Chinese philosophy mm-hmm. as being concerned really with what's good for you, with how mm-hmm. society is to be run and how the individual life is to be led, rather than with considerations of the problem of how we know about the natural world and things like that. Is that fair?
Yes and no. And I hate giving yes and no answers because it's kind of typical of philosophers splitting hairs. In general, yes, when you have a quick snapshot of Chinese philosophy, what you tend to get is the ancient Chinese philosophers weren't too much concerned with looking at the world and describing the world. They wanted to make philosophy work for them. But incidentally, having said that too, the phrase that depicts Chinese philosophy, zexie, is actually a Japanese term. So, you know, there was no consciousness of philosophy as in love of wisdom in early Chinese philosophy. There was a lot of reflection on what's going on, where are we going, how are we going to get there. And so when you study Chinese philosophy, that's what you come to grips with, a very, very practically oriented, reflective, question-asking activity. And then on the other hand, you do get later on, around 200 BCE, with the Maoists, much more philosophical questions, philosophical in the sense of navel-gazing questions, looking at argumentation, at logic, at now, disputation.
This is the school of Mozu?
Mozu, that's right.
Somebody was telling me the other week that although there's been a revival of interest in Maoism in recent years, mm-hmm. the texts are in a very, very bad shape because nobody really cared about them, unlike Confucian texts, which are in a much better condition.
That's right. Although, you know, that may be a blessing in disguise. You know, the Confucian Analects has had interpretation upon interpretation, layer upon layer. And so it's very hard to study the Analects without also understanding the layers that have been put on through time.
The same person I was talking to, who was Robert Wardy, reader in ancient philosophy at the University of Cambridge, he was very interested in Chinese as well as Greek philosophy. And he said that he thought the Confucian classic, the Analects, which you've mentioned, he thought it was a truly great work, but he thought that if you were a Western reader approaching it, expecting philosophy, what you as a Western reader think of as philosophy, you were doomed to disappointment. Do you think that's true?
I think so. I'll illustrate this, again, taking the plunge. If you think about Euthyphro's conversation with Socrates, for instance, when Euthyphro is trying to describe piety and Socrates is dragging it out of him, at one point Socrates says, well, you know, let's get back to the point. Tell me what piety is. And Euthyphro then goes back to that specific instance of piety and Socrates says, look, I don't like this. We're not talking about instances. I want you to give me a general principle of what piety is. And that seems to me to capture at least one dominant approach in Western philosophy, in Greek philosophy, of looking at the general principles. So the general principle that made pious acts pious. If you read the Analects, all you have are instances. There is no general principle. And I consider it great work of philosophy because it invites readers then to work through these instances to come up with their general principles.
Caroline, from the point of view of somebody whose focus is Western philosophy and is also ethics, how do you see the basics of what you're trying to do? in terms of David's distinction, what's it all about and how is this going to help? I mean, you're just interested in helping.
I think that David's absolutely right, that there is a sort of a deep tension, especially evident in ethics, but evident more generally as well, between philosophy conceived of as helping you to live a better life as an individual or as a community, and philosophy as the pursuit of truth. And in ethics, those two different aspects of philosophy can become dangerously blurred. So you find people who are doing ethics, what they want is an answer to the question, the very practical question of how should I live, what's a virtuous life. And then if philosophical inquiry, the pursuit of truth, starts leading them in a different direction, a direction which seems uncongenial or unpalatable, people are tempted to think that it must be mistaken. So that if the truth seems unpalatable, then people conclude that such and such a view couldn't be right.
I suppose an example of somebody who had followed his ethical deductions, even though they might not be pleasant, would be, say, Peter Singer. With his utilitarian approach to life, he thinks that we should consider the interests of animals as well as of human beings. So, you know, that means no meat, it means plastic shoes, it means all sorts. And it also means that you really ought to be spending more money on the welfare of others than most of us probably do. So that looks really, really rigorous.
I think that's actually a lovely example of the sort of thing that I have in mind. You know, people reject utilitarianism precisely because it delivers conclusions that don't seem to be to them good ways of living. So they conclude not that utilitarianism's unpalatable or something, but that it's actually false.
Another fabulous example of this kind of thing is a famous paper by an American philosopher called Michael Tooley, who wrote a paper about abortion and infanticide, which defended the view that infanticide is perfectly okay, provided the kids are young enough not to have their own conception of their plans and so on in the world. And that paper's got terrifically good arguments in it, and there's been enormous literature complaining about it and issuing kind of, you know, denunciations of it, but very few really good considered responses to the argument.
But isn't it reasonable for me, if I am facing that very issue, to go with my instincts? My instincts are to preserve the life of the newly born child. My instincts might also be to preserve what people refer to as the unborn child, but I think the presence of the being clearly visible in front of me and no longer attached by an umbilical cord, that tugs at my instincts. Is it a bad thing for me to yield to my instincts? Is it indeed an unphilosophical thing?
Goodness, no. Very good idea to yield to your instincts in these cases. Never do something that just feels to you appallingly bad just because there's a very good argument which says that it's quite okay. On the other hand, while you yield to your instincts, don't be convinced there's no chance that the conclusion of that argument could be true. I think that's what I mean by separating the how to live and what to think questions. You're much more likely to get to both truth and practical wisdom by keeping truth and practical wisdom apart.
On ABC Radio National, you're listening to The Philosopher's Zone. And I'm asking the question, what is it that we talk about on The Philosopher's Zone every week? What is philosophy? And to help me out, I'm joined by David Braddon-Mitchell and Caroline West from the University of Sydney and Karen Lai from the University of New South Wales. David, I have talked to philosophers of science who think that basically what they're doing is continuous with science. It's not as though they're putting science in a metaphysical context. It's not as though they are telling scientists how to go about their work. It is in some sense continuous with science. Do you see philosophy as differing in an important respect from empirical subjects like physics and biology?
Well, there's a trivial sense in which I'm sure it's different from empirical subjects, in that it's not concerned with adding to the store of empirical information, which empirical subjects are. But of course, empirical subjects do something else besides add to the store of empirical information. They think about the empirical information, they form theories out of the empirical information, they try to reconcile the empirical information with other things that they know, and they think reflectively about what counts as good evidence for revising your views about empirical information. Now, I think those things that empirical scientists do are philosophical things. So to that extent, I think philosophy is continuous with science, although perhaps it's better to say that science is continuous with philosophy, because after all, philosophers were doing those things long before the natural sciences were spun off from it.
Well, this brings us to another question, which is that physicists don't have to read Newton, whereas philosophers are still reading the same old stuff. I mean, we're reading ancient stuff like Confucius, like Lao Tse, like Aristotle, like Plato. It looks as though philosophy doesn't make progress. Caroline, do you think we're progressing?
I do. I think we've progressed a lot. I think often when people go back to old texts, they're mining them for ideas and so on to feed into current debates, which are often being conducted in quite different terms from the terms in which the debate was situated back then. So I think we've made progress on all kinds of issues in philosophy. I think in ethics, for example, we have a much clearer sense of what the different problems are, a much clearer sense of the terrain, what the positions are that you might take with respect to these questions, and what are the consistent packages and so on. That's not to say that we all agree about which of those packages is right, but I think certainly we've got much clearer understanding both of the theories and the arguments and the problems that are there to be solved.
Actually, one of the interesting things about Anglo-American philosophy the last 20 years is that it's surprising how often people who work in that sort of contemporary tradition don't read the texts of what some call the dead.
In fact,
philosophy books by dead people are much less read. Maybe they're not read enough, in fact, anymore. But one danger, I think, is that when people do read classic texts by dead philosophers, is they completely misunderstand them, because so much philosophy is a reaction to particular intellectual climates and particular pieces of intellectual history, that people who read these books simply read them in the light of their current concerns. And often it does no good either to the history of ideas on the one hand or to contemporary philosophy on the other.
I agree completely with David that you can do a lot of danger to the classical texts if you don't understand the situation that was there. And this relates to, you know, the definition of philosophy in two ways, either the search for truth or a search for wisdom. And indeed, the study of the texts, the ancient texts, feeds into the second, you know, the search for wisdom. We can only gain more by looking at how people reacted to different scenarios.
So from what you say about the way in which the Confucian analects proceed, that is to say on a case-by-case basis without overarching generalities, as you would expect to find in a Western philosopher, so relating it directly to concrete circumstances, be they historical or not, seems to be a very Confucian way of proceeding.
And indeed a very dominant theme in Chinese philosophy. So you have, for instance, from the Confucian tradition, the analects. You also have Sun Tzu's The Art of War. You know, it's all very pragmatically focused. You also have the Taoist texts that, you know, talk about acquiescence, understanding the world, and sometimes it's the best thing to do to yield, perhaps.
When I first started as a philosophy student, I went to university to do law, and I found that my reading was taking me away from law, pure and simple, towards the philosophy of law, towards jurisprudence. And so I decided that what I was really interested in was philosophy. And so I changed from a very good law department to a not very good philosophy department. Not in this country, I should add.
There are no bad philosophy departments.
No, that's right. Well, my one doesn't exist anymore. That's how bad it was. But I ended up doing single subject philosophy, which you can do or could do in England at that time. And it rapidly became apparent to me that it was very difficult just to do philosophy, because the problems of philosophy very often come from outside philosophy. They come from science, politics, religion, or daily life. Caroline, do you think that's true, that you need to do something other than philosophy? You need some stimulus external to philosophy to make you want to reflect upon what you're doing.
I'm not sure. I mean, I think the question that we're talking about today, the question of what is philosophy, I don't know whether that counts as an internal kind of question or an
external. Yeah.
Right. Well, I mean, certainly true that philosophers, there's philosophy of law and philosophy of science and philosophy of history and so on. But it seems that there are, I mean, one thing philosophers have been keen to do is to reflect on the methods of philosophy itself, on what we're doing when we do philosophy. And so if those count as distinctively kind of philosophical questions, then it seems to me that philosophy is as reflective about its own method often as it is about other disciplines.
What's your view on this, David?
Oh, I certainly think that if philosophy doesn't have something to say outside of itself, then it's a slightly onanistic sort of enterprise. So the best philosophy seems to be philosophy which is very reflective about philosophy and then goes and says something about something else, says something about the mind, says something about the natural sciences, says something about biology, says something about culture, says something about justice, says something about politics. So yeah, I think a philosopher needs to be someone who's engaged. And I think many good philosophers, and I think probably true of all of the ones here, do have some pretty solid groundings in areas outside philosophy. It's very hard to find someone who did nothing but philosophy.
And thank you, David, for using the word onanistic, which is so more Radio National than any of the alternatives that spring to mind. Yes. Karen, I take it that the ethical bias of a lot of classical Chinese philosophy means that the problems do come from elsewhere. They're not internal.
No, that's right. Although, again, you know, referring back to the Maoists, they really were very concerned about language, about the role of language, you know, in picking up various features of the world. They're very concerned about argumentation, and the Taoists were in fact convinced about the arbitrariness of language.
And we should say that there are philosophical traditions other than the European and the Chinese one, and of course I think Indian philosophy is a bit more concerned with logic and epistemological issues. Let me just close by asking you, you all teach philosophy, which means that you all have to face first-year students coming to philosophy, and I want to know why they do it. I've told you why I did it, but Caroline, why do your students want to do philosophy?
I think they come for all sorts of reasons. One is the reason that you've mentioned, that they love the freedom to think about the kind of meta issues, if you like, think about the nature of justice rather than kind of applying this or that legal principle. I think they come because it's fun, because the activity of philosophizing is enjoyable. I think they come often because, I think this is especially true of practical ethics courses, for example, they come because they're looking for a rigorous way of thinking about pressing practical questions like abortion and euthanasia and infanticide. They want answers, in other words, to those things, and they're coming to philosophy in search of answers.
David, Caroline thinks philosophy is fun. Nothing more fun than first-order monadic predicate calculus in logic, and that's my view.
Absolutely.
Do you get the same students?
I do get the same students. Caroline and I both teach segments in the same first-year course. I get two sorts of students who come and tell me why they're doing philosophy. Some of them want to know how to live, and they're normally a little bit disappointed, but they enjoy inquiring into it. But there's another kind of student, and there's hundreds of them. I give a lecture on personal identity, and at the end of it, I get students coming up to me and saying, I've been wondering for years, what would happen if the contents of my brain were downloaded onto a computer and my body was destroyed? Would I still exist? I've always worried about that. And at last, here's a course at uni where you can talk about just that kind of cool stuff. That's one kind of student. It's about a third of them, I think.
Yeah, although sometimes they discover, you know, that the prospect of life after the death of your body might be incoherent. They get a little disturbed by that, I think.
They do.
Yeah.
Well, if they have problems about personal identity, I think the correct answer is, who wants to know? Karen, what about your students?
I have turned off students from philosophy, you know, walking into the very first year ethics lecture and saying, this is what we're doing. We're doing this activity together, you know, through in this course, through the lectures and the tutorials. We're doing lots of thinking and reflecting together. If you've come to do this, you're in the right class. But if you've come for the answers, as in how am I to decide exactly what I do in that situation, then you're probably in the wrong class. And I did have one young girl come after the class to speak to me. I don't think philosophy is for me, she said. She wanted the answer. She said, I thought I could find out. She, in all seriousness, I thought I could find out, but maybe it's not for me.
Well, I hope this program has been for you, and I hope we've made things more clear, or at least more interestingly confused. David Braddon Mitchell, Caroline West and Karen Lai, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
The show was produced by Polly Rickard, with technical production from Jenny Parsonage and Janita Palmer. I'm Alan Saunders, and I'll be back next week with another Philosopher's Zone.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. And we're live on the net, as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.